From KALW and PRX, this is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller with stories of how women rise up. I think it's fair to say that I talk with amazing women in every episode of this show. Sometimes they come from far-off lands, and other times they're in my own backyard. Today's guest is all three of those things. As the long-standing head of the lower school at St. Anne's School in Brooklyn, now widely considered one of the top K-12 schools in the country, Gabe Howard changed the way an entire generation of kids embraced learning. So, she's amazing. Check. She comes from England. Far off land. Check. And lucky for me, and a first for this show, we're related by marriage. Own backyard. Check. At the same time we were discussing recording this interview, Gabe was preparing to retire from St. Anne's. So I had some competition for her attention and a high bar to reach in my questions, since her most important constituents got to her first. Gabe told me that her favorite interview so far had been with a couple of third graders who asked her, "As you prepare to ride off into the sunset, what kind of horse do you have?" I am not sure how to top that, but I did want to know more about Gabe Howard, and Gabe Howard is a third grader herself, and how that led to her lifelong dedication to education. So that's where we started our conversation. Gabriel Howard went to school in a small town in England.
I went to very strict schools for all of my education. And I really loved to talk, and you weren't allowed to talk. And I was always in trouble for talking.
I began to see just how important her story is, not only because she helped to shape a new approach to teaching kids.
Well, I fell in love with the school. Children's voices were what the school was all about. It wasn't about, you know, being quiet and not talking too much. It was all about, we want to know what you have to say.
But like many immigrants, her vision of America was a bit idealized.
Having grown up during the war and been exposed to McCall's and other American magazines, I thought, well, that is definitely the place to be. So I fed on suburban houses and refrigerators and ham and big cars, and none of that happened.
And also, sometimes the things we have to learn from the people we love can't reveal themselves until we just sit down, face to face, and talk. Now, often, the story you hear from women in Gabe's generation is, well, I wanted to be an actress, or I wanted to be an engineer. But in the end, I had to teach, because that's what was realistic. In Gabe's case, she wanted to teach deaf children, but didn't.
It would have meant that I had to go to university at a time when 2% of the eligible population went to university. It was a really different time. And I suppose also it was probably a phase that I wanted to do that to some extent. You know, I certainly didn't continue to push for it. And anyway, I didn't do that. I designed bathing suits.
It's true. She could even visit Marks and Spencer in London and see who was buying which of her designs. But the desire to teach still lingered. Eventually, Gabe got married, moved to America, had children, and did go back to college. But between getting her undergraduate degree and going to grad school, she needed to find work. And teaching was work she could do while her kids were in school. And that's how she became acquainted with St. Anne's School in Brooklyn. St. Anne's was an experimental school that rebuffed all the usual norms about how to teach kids and who could teach them. And in particular, it rebuffed, and still does, the speak-until-spoken-to norm that Gabe herself had grown up with.
I did not love school, and I think that one of the worst things you can do to a child is to beat the desire to converse out of them. And while I wasn't literally beaten, I was certainly shamed into not talking as much as my inclination would have it. I think they made conversing not come as naturally as it had when I was little. Maybe that happens to everyone, but I do remember being all the time told that I talk too much.
Well, let's talk about what happened between the time that you arrived, decided to stay, and then actually did enter education as your career field.
I went to college. I went to Long Island University because that was where my then husband was teaching and I could go for free. And they would have me with very few academic credentials. So I got a degree and then I was going to go to graduate school, but in between getting a degree and going to graduate school, I wanted to make some money. And I had two small children at that point, and teaching was something I could do without having to pay a babysitter because they were in school and I was in school. And I ended up teaching in a private school, but initially I wanted to teach in a public school, but I couldn't teach in a public school because I wasn't a citizen. And I didn't, in fact, become a citizen until a lot later, when I'd never voted in my life, and I wanted to vote for Bill Clinton, so I became a citizen. So he's responsible for a lot of shit.
So it wasn't until the 90s that
I'd been here 36 years before I became a citizen. And that's the longing for home, you know. That's the saying, no, I'm not really English anymore.
Yeah.
I'm an American now.
Yeah. So you were telling me that you came over on a visa because your husband at the time was a scientist.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about how that worked?
It was a little after the time that Sputnik had gone up and America was looking for European scientists, and he had a PhD in physical chemistry. And we had both of us always wanted to go to America.
Well, I should probably say that the man you came with, who was your husband at the time, was not a citizen, but you've been here in America for a while and were then dating an American. And so you could have gotten citizenship at any time by marrying him, but you chose not to.
I guess I didn't want to become a citizen that much. I mean, I didn't really want to become a citizen. I wanted to vote. You know, it was the vote, it was the never having had that voice that motivated me, and that's a voice that a lot of women work really hard to get me.
Yeah.
To have.
Yeah. But I am curious about that choice to not get married. Until very recently.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, we had a good thing going, you know. It didn't seem necessary, and then suddenly it did. And I think part of that is just aging. You know, I had visions of being in a hospital, dying, and Marty couldn't come and see me because we weren't married or something like that.
Now he can.
Maybe that would never happen, but...
Okay, well, let's get back on track. Let's go back to England. What was your life like back in England?
Well, it was pretty deprived. I mean, I was given the possibilities, I was one of the lucky ones. I wasn't shipped off to live with another family. I lived with my mother in the house that we had always lived in. And since it had always been that way, I took for granted that there wasn't a lot of food and you couldn't always have what you wanted. And you certainly couldn't have candy or sweets, as we called them at the time. But there weren't many cars, you know, and that's a good thing. There certainly was a lot less packaging, and that's a good thing. But it did look really sort of super luxurious, and that was, you know, interesting. I suppose I was about 9 when I started wanting to come to America.
Wow. That's a lifelong aspiration.
Yeah. And then I wanted to go home.
You know? Once you got here.
Once I got here, I wanted to go home. But that's not entirely true, because I love New York. I mean, from the get-go, I love New York. And we actually arrived 2 days before Kennedy was shot. And that was, well, I mean, it sort of goes without saying that that was stunning.
Yeah.
It was stunning for everybody. You know, it occurred to me that shootings were so unusual in those days that Harold Macmillan was prime minister in England at the time, and that nobody would ever shoot him unless they mistook him for a grouse or something like that.
So that was your introduction to American culture?
That was my introduction to American culture, yes.
So what were your impressions when, I mean, that must have colored everything about your impressions when you arrived versus what you imagined it would be?
I'd say yes and no. It was just part of the whole remarkable experience of being here, you know, and it was, the weather was so blue and so cold, and coming from England, I had to some extent expected that if you had blue skies, you had warm weather. And it was absolutely freezing and so blue.
So you ended up, you surpassed your year when you thought you would go home. And I mean, once you got past that, do you still miss England? I mean, at that point, were you wanting to go back for real, or you really just were nostalgic about it?
Yes, you know, I have an immigrant's longing for home, and I expect to always have it.
When you were growing up in England, and so you got married, but was it a choice of, I mean, now when you think about that time, it's like going to college versus getting married, whereas now it doesn't really, people don't really think about that as a choice. Was that actually something that you had to make a decision about doing?
No. I went to an art college. I did dress design and at Leicester College of Art. And I had done that by the time we got married, but we had known each other since we were 17. So it was a, you know, like a high school relationship.
Wow. I didn't know you had a degree in dress design.
Yeah.
Do you ever use that?
No.
No? No. You don't, you're not sketching?
No.
Never?
No.
Wow.
I mean, I did do swimsuit design for a while.
You did professionally?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
When I lived in London, that's what I did. I worked for a supplier of Marks and Spencer's.
That's so cool.
It was fun.
Do you still have the drawings that you made, the
No.
designs that you made?
No.
Do you have any of the bathing suits that you made?
No.
No?
I can remember them, though. And the office that I worked in was close to the Marks and Spencers that was on Oxford Street. And you could go down in your lunch hour and watch people buy the swimsuits that you designed.
That's amazing.
That was.
And did you,
or not buy them.
Right.
They didn't always buy them.
Did you ever look at anyone and say, maybe that wasn't the right choice for you?
I'm sure I did.
No judgment. How did you get connected with St. Anne's to start with? Because it was its early days.
Yeah, it was the time-honored tradition of nepotism. I had a friend who was friends with the person who was the current head of the lower school there. And she said, oh, you have to meet my friend Jim Madison. So I met Jim Madison and he hired me. And I stayed for 44 years. I was
like,
going to teach for a year.
Yeah. You have a lot of one-year plans that seem to extend. What's your next one-year plan?
I'm going to die.
Oh, God.
For a year.
Right. So we have 44 more years of Gabe Howard. Thank goodness. Can we talk a little bit about just to get to the philosophy of St. Anne's and where it all sprang from. So Stanley Bosworth, was mm-hmm. he was the original conceiver?
He was the
original conceiver.
Founding headmaster.
And it was his concept, that the school, or?
It was his concept.
How did he talk about what he wanted the school to be?
Well, one of the things that made it work was that he talked about it all the time. He talked about his passionate desire for literacy and for intellectual endeavor and for poetry and for art and for music. And he believed that those things and a few others I haven't named are what make life and children sacred. And he knew that children were sacred, and that was how the school progressed. And because he said it all the time, everybody was kind of on board with it. It wasn't Nirvana.
I know. From afar, St. Anne's is totally Nirvana. So what
it wasn't Nirvana, and it was bloody hard work, and it was underpaid, and but you always felt like you were doing something important and valuable, and that's what kept me there so long. And if I wasn't there, where would I go?
Uh-huh. What was the affiliation of St. Anne's School with St. Anne's Church?
The members of the church, wanted to start a school because the public school in the neighborhood, they didn't like the private schools that were there already. And there were a couple of them. And or the public school. And so they wanted to start a school. And so they had to find somebody to run it. And the person who was in charge at the church was a man named Canon Harcourt. And he and Stanley, although they were strange bedfellows, not that they ever went to bed. Stanley was fiercely heterosexual.
Just to be clear.
He was gone by the time, I think the school was 7 years old by the time I got there, and Canon Harcourt had returned to England. And but there were stories of him walking the halls and wearing a purple robe and smelling of lavender and telling Bible stories to the kids. But the friendship, there was the friendship between those two men. Other than that, St. Anne's, who has a very large Jewish population, was not an Episcopalian school. And that was a few years later, that was ratified in a way, because the church and the school separated, although we have celebrations in the church. It's available for graduation and concerts, and it's a really beautiful, really beautiful old church.
So how did you think of your, coming into this school, which sounds completely different from your own experience of school? Like, what was your role as the teacher, and how did you figure out how you wanted to be that person, having not personally experienced anything like that before?
I'd always loved kids, and even when I was a kid myself, I loved littler kids. And so teaching, in a way, came very naturally to me. And I wanted to know what they had to say. And so I listened to them.
Yeah.
And, I had things that you could teach. You could, and you still can, teach anything you want to teach at St. Anne's in the lower school. You can teach, if you want your curriculum to be the Middle Ages, you can teach that. If you want it to be ancient Greece, you can teach that. If you want it to be surrealism, anything you want it to be. I mean, as long as you can engage the kids in a passion for learning, and as long as they, along with that, learn to read and write and compute and talk and listen to each other. I thought that was just fantastic. And it is, because, and it keeps teachers there, because there's so much autonomy. It's really satisfying. And if you, when you're in a classroom, you know if it's not working. And anybody who walks in, who knows anything about anybody, anything about anything to do with teaching, would know that it's not working. And when it's working, it's equally tangible.
And as a private school, are there test requirements like we have in public schools where there has to be some sort of measure of the kids' progress?
No, there aren't. What really happens is, in the end, they go to college.
And you have to wait 12 years to know if it worked.
And if they don't go to college, and if they don't go to the colleges that people expect them to go to, then I think that you would soon be out of business.
Yeah.
You know, it's, there is a, you know, in that sense, there is a measure. And they take, and the kids take the same tests everybody takes. They take the SATs and
the advanced placement tests.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But they don't, there are no grades. And that's huge because, you know, kids will measure themselves, and some more than others, but kids will measure themselves against each other anyway. But if you take away the tangible grade expression of what you're doing, then you minimize the competitiveness. Mm-hmm. Instead of exacerbating it, you minimize it.
Well, this idea, so just thinking for a second about the ultimate measure of how well the school, quote unquote, did for the child, being did they go to a good college or did they go to the college that their parents wanted them to go to or that they, the student themselves, aspired to go to. I feel like the notion in New York is that if you don't get your kid on the right list for the right preschool while they're still in utero, you may as well just say goodbye to their entire potential for success for the rest of their life. And so much anxiety around that. And but it seems like that goal and the philosophy of St. Anne's actually don't, like, I wouldn't actually connect those two things together, that the goal would be to end up going to a good college.
Well, I think if there weren't enough kids going to good colleges, then people would question the validity of the school. But in reality, the goal is that you leave as a person who already, you leave St. Anne's already as a person who has interests and things they want to do, and that they can become an accomplished and a happy person. That's, I mean, I think in that way it's transcendent and not just dependent on getting into a good school. But as a New York City private school, if kids weren't going to good colleges, then it would not be considered the success it is, even though that's an ephemeral success compared to the real success.
It's inspiring to think about what happens when teachers are given the freedom and resources to guide their students toward discoveries rather than just toward higher test scores. What happens when we take the pressure off our schools to achieve and instead lift them up so every teacher, regardless of how wealthy their students are, can inspire a lifelong love of learning? Coming up after the break, we'll go inside the classroom with Gabe Howard.
You can set them free, and adults just as much as children like to be set free.
I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point. I'm talking with Gabriel Howard, who recently retired as head of the lower school at St. Anne's School, where she was for 35 years. At the time that you started working with St. Anne's, even though they'd been around for 7 years, the work that you were doing, I feel like, was really groundbreaking.
When you're in a situation where teachers feel trusted and they have autonomy, then they have a big investment in making it work. And they also have to be people who are intelligent and literate and have interests of their own, and people who love kids and who have a sense of humor. And if you have people like that, then you can set them free. And adults just as much as children like to be set free. And so if you're studying the Revolutionary War 1 year and you get tired of it and you decide you want to do Arabian Nights, then you can change it, and there is no red tape. You just do it because you're trusted. And then it reinvigorates your teaching to do something like that. You have to study it. Making a curriculum is a huge undertaking. And so you know you're going to be studying it yourself as well. And then the kids bring themselves to it. And that's really the joy of it.
What was your moment of discovering what that could feel like for you?
Oh, that was a really long time ago. You know, I think it was. It goes back to when I told you that, I went there for a year, and then I fell in love with it, and I fell in love with the freedom and the trust and with the children who once you're listening to them with each other and listening to them with you, they kind of show you the way. And I don't mean by that they plan the curriculum although in some schools they do that, but they certainly guide it in different directions. And an art project can be something just amazing that came out of something that a kid has done.
Can you get specific?
Oh. Yeah, I mean, they'll sit with a pair of scissors and a piece of paper, and suddenly you have a puppet, or you have a train, or you have a dinosaur, and then everybody wants to do it. They just build things, you know. And little kids, although I'm not working at St. Anne's anymore, I go into our preschool one day a week and play with the three-year-olds. And the stuff that they come up with is absolutely phenomenal. And they make art all day long. And all the time they're learning, you know, dexterity and appreciation. And they feel like artists, and they feel like poets.
So you went from being an assistant teacher to running the entire lower school.
Yes.
Yeah. But you spent a significant amount of time in the classroom, and you still would meet with the children.
Yes.
One-on-one, even after you were in the administrative role.
Yes.
Right? So in this free-willing, free-spirited school, I'm sure that there were still kids who were biting, scratching, kicking, swearing, you know, doing all the things that little kids
yes.
do to find their boundaries.
Yes.
How did you handle those kinds of situations?
Well, we talk about swearing, right?
Yeah, let's do it. Love swearing on this show.
The thing about a so-called bad language in the classroom is not really the language, but that it gets everybody riled up. And you don't really want a whole class of kids riled up about somebody saying fuck or whatever they're saying. And so I had kids, if it happened, which it, and it didn't happen very often, but if it did, and a teacher would send a kid to me because they weren't responding to their saying, you can't say that in the classroom, I would tell them they could say it in the office. They could come and say whatever they liked because I didn't care what they said. And they would look at me. and so I said, so go on.
Well, it's not as much fun when you're given permission.
No, I think it's a little unnerving. And it just kind of ended. It was a really great way of saying, you know, I said, I don't really care about the words, but I do care that you don't listen to your teacher, and you need to listen to your teacher, and this is why she's telling you this, because it makes everybody giddy, doesn't it? And they go, yeah. So that's an example of a way to not really be punitive, but to change behavior. And I had one little boy once who took me up on it.
Yeah, just one out of many.
He just sat there and he swore like a trooper for about 4 minutes.
Wow.
But he didn't come back and do it again.
Yeah. I mean, St. Anne's is, I would say, considered an elite private school, and people are banking their entire children's lives on where they go to school from the time they start in preschool, in New York City especially. And so when it comes to the admissions process and the selection, I imagine that there are some people who will try and do anything to get their kid into the school. Are there any crazy stories or anecdotes about what parents have tried that would be just, let's say, a cautionary tale to others who might try and do the same? It didn't work.
Oh, well, we don't accept bribes.
Has that people tried to bribe?
And
you're not answering.
I suppose as a cautionary tale, I would say, don't send too much paperwork. Don't send huge numbers of letters from people who want to tell us why we should take a child, or lots and lots and lots of the kids' work. Some of the kids' work is fine, but you know, if there's a huge file of papers and you haven't admitted the child yet, then it sort of rings bells. Cautionary bells.
So don't try too hard.
Right. Don't try too hard. And, you know, and it's important to find the right school for your kid. And, you know, I'm sure there isn't a school in existence that is the right school for everybody.
Yeah, right. I mean, you ran admissions for a while. So what was the spark that you looked for in the kids that came through? Because you would talk to the kids before they came into the school.
I did admissions in a different time. Mm. I did admissions in a time when Stanley and I were out beating the bushes looking for kids. Mm-hmm. And St. Anne's was that school in Brooklyn.
That weird hippie school?
Weird school in Brooklyn.
What was it?
With
how
the
was
crazy it? Headmaster.
Okay, I was going to say, how was it characterized at that time?
Yeah. And we took kids that we don't take so much now. We took kids who had been kicked out of other schools, and kids who were very unevenly talented, and we made it work for them. So it was. You looked for, or at least I did, I'd look for divergent thinking. I looked for kids who would say really surprising things, and that wrong answers are often much better than right answers. And so when you're actually seeing the kid, you can take that into consideration. When you get IQ scores that have been done somewhere else, then the people who score the tests can't give credit for wrong answers. And I mean, in a sense, the wrong answers, often the really great wrong answers, come from really creative kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important thing to look for. And yeah, it was fun doing admissions when you were beating the bushes.
Yeah. What a different time. Mm. Did you run into any naysayers who said, I would never send my child to that school?
I said that.
You said that about your own children. So yeah. So they were not there while you were teaching at the beginning?
Not at the beginning. Uh-huh. And I was a naysayer. When I looked at the school for my children, and in those days they didn't show you the school, which was a little suspect.
You couldn't go inside?
You couldn't actually go and see the school, but you went into Stanley's office and listened to Stanley. And I said, I would never send my children to a school run by a man like that.
Why?
Because he was crazy. But then he hired me. And I wasn't so fussy when it came to getting a job. So yes, there were naysayers, and you know, and rightfully so. It's not right for everybody. And if you want to get very measured, in the sense of a measurement feedback on your child on a regular basis, if you want to be able to go online and look up how they did today, the standards would drive you crazy.
Right. So I feel like we can't complete this conversation without talking about poetry in the classroom.
Yeah.
That's because the reason I know you is because you met my father-in-law when you were both teaching at St. Anne's. You could say poetry brought you together when he walked into your classroom.
Yes. Yes. He came to teach poetry in Justin's classroom, in his son's classroom, with whom you are familiar.
I am familiar.
He was open to coming to other classrooms too. He wasn't getting paid at this time. And the person who hired me, Jim Madison, said, does anybody else want him? And I said, I'll have him. So I did.
Sight unseen, or after you'd just given him a little once over?
Yeah, a little bit of a once over.
So he started coming into the classroom.
Yes. And then he started coming in more. and then the poetry that we did, we put up on the walls all over the school the poetry that the kids had written. And that informed the whole school of what was going on. And kids would stop on the stairs and read the poems that had been written by these really little kids. And many of them were hilarious. And then he just started teaching more and more. He went till he ended up teaching all of the lower school classes, and then when his third graders moved to middle school, he moved to teach just a handful of them, and then it got more and more and more until, you know, poetry at St. Anne's became kind of mythic, and he got an enormous amount of support from Stanley, who deeply loved poetry and knew poetry. And he would one day he called Marty at like 12 o'clock at night or 1 in the morning and said, bring me Hannah Jones, because he'd just read a poem by Hannah Jones.
Right now?
So Marty Jones leapt out of bed, ran over to Hannah's house.
No.
No, it didn't.
Hannah was a student at the time?
Yeah.
And that, but it seems like that started off with the process of collecting the poems from these kids, for at least from what I understand. It seems like it started off with listening to them.
Yes.
And what they had to say.
Yes. Here we go again.
Here we go again. Yeah. So, I mean, if you could recollect how that collection process happened, or an example of how that happened.
Yes, he starts by going into the classroom, going into the first grade classrooms, which is when he starts teaching poetry, on the first day of school, and listening to what they're saying and writing down things they say. And then he puts it all together and he goes back into the classroom for the next poetry time and he reads them what they have said, and they get so excited. They say, "I said that! I said that! You know, you said that!" And it gives them the sense of how free a poem can be and how much it can be just a part of your life and isn't. There's no constraints. The constraints and the value of constraints come later, but that's how he starts. And then when he goes in, they've already had two great experiences with him. And so he says, you know, "We're going to write a poem." And they stand next to him and dictate a poem to him. And you can't, he doesn't take more than a page, because you could, some people don't want to start and some people don't want to stop. And so I suppose there is a constraint in
there.
More than a page, you have to write it yourself.
Okay.
And if you're six, that's more, a little daunting sometimes.
What's the best advice that you've ever been given about how to carry on, even when there are loads of people telling you that's not how it should be done?
I think I'm not very good at taking advice.
That's not a shocker. Well, what about, I mean, again, it's easy to look at the work at St. Anne's now and think, well, it's considered one of the best schools in the country. They're obviously doing something right. But at the time, when you started there in the early days, it was going against the norm. And you must have had to have some level of fortitude or something that was keeping you going in spite of hearing, "That's crazy. What are you people thinking over there?" And how did you push through that?
Well, people did say it's crazy. And the sort of bottom line retort is that it works for us, and it may not work for you. And there are lots of schools in this world, and this is the way we do it. You know, I mean, it's ultimately, we'd kind of draw some line. And really, if people do want you to do something differently, then they should find a place that does it differently.
Yeah. So that sounds,
if it's a profound difference.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like having the conviction of your beliefs and standing and sticking with them.
Yeah.
Speaking with Gabe made me think more about education in general. And right now, when it comes to investing in schools, our national conversation has revolved more around revolvers and creating secure buildings and giving teachers guns to defend kids from active shooters. But what happens when we create environments where, from a very young age, children are safe to be curious, to experiment, to investigate, and to express themselves, even swear, inside these buildings? Investment in this type of education is the best investment you can make to teach kids to stand up and be heard, not sit down and be quiet. Many of you parents out there might be thinking of ways to thank your kids' teachers for their dedication to your children's learning. Along with a thank you note, show your gratitude and advocacy for your children's teachers by researching how your local representatives vote on investing in education. And vote for candidates who make funding our public schools and giving our teachers a fair living wage a top priority. You can learn more about state education bills currently up for vote
who proposed them, and how your representatives voted at ncsl.org. I'll put a link in our show notes at inflectionpointradio.org. This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. That's our Inflection Point for today. All of our episodes are on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, Stitcher, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the podcast. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, I invite you to support Inflection Point with a monthly or one-time contribution. Your support keeps women's stories front and center. Just go to inflectionpointradio.org. We're on Facebook at Inflection Point Radio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. To find out more about the guests you heard today and to sign up for our email newsletter, you know where to go, inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.